Martin Daly works for the Dublin City Council in Ireland and is a member of the Dublin Billiards and Snooker League's committee and the Republic of Ireland Billiards and Snooker Association. Martin, I met you when we were in Galway and there was a championship, a snooker championship going on, and you guys were all staying in the same hotel. And Roselle and I were fascinated by the game of snooker. And you were kind enough to give us a couple of passes to go up and watch one of the championships. And it was like being in Wimbledon or Forest Hills and watching a tennis match. Not a breath. Nobody said a word. So we were just so taken with it. We thought maybe we could do it just a few minutes on the radio and I could ask you to describe what snooker is and why it is so popular in Ireland.
Well, snooker has been very, very popular in the British Isles, Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, for about 35 years now. It gets very good coverage on TV here, and most of the professionals and the top players in the world are from that region. So it sort of pervades sporting life here. We get a lot in the media, all forms of the media, especially when it's coming up to big tournaments and that sort of thing. So, for example, the one in the Merrick Hotel had the top 24 players after a series of events, 12 events. And the guy I sort of pal with, Fergal, was the only Irish player in it. But we had something like five ex-world champions as well. So it draws good crowds. It can be breathtaking. It requires a massive amount of skill, dedication, perseverance. The average professional probably spends 12, 13 years playing before they ever really get to the very high level of the game, you know. So there are only 96 professionals in the world. It's very, very difficult to even qualify to be a professional.
Can they make money at it, Martin? Big money?
Well, in the past season, the season usually starts in around the middle of June now and finishes with the World Championships, and the final is on the first weekend in the final tournament ends on the first weekend of May. And last season now, which is just completed a couple of weeks ago, had $8 million in tournament prizes.
Wow.
So add some sponsorship to that and the likes of doing exhibitions in clubs and other non-official tournaments, if you like, held in clubs or in different countries where people are invited to play as well. So, yes, yeah, certainly the top 16 players would make a very decent living. They'd make sort of probably about $150,000 for, let's say, players 9 to 16 in the rankings in the world. Players 1 to 4 are more likely to make from the main tournaments probably in the region of $400,000 a year. The World Championship alone, which for the top 16 players lasts 17 days, others have to pre-qualify for it. But the winner alone gets $400,000.
Well, there may be people who are listening to us, Martin Daly, who don't even know what snooker is. So could you describe it for us?
Yeah. Well, it's a derivative of billiards. So it's basically a 12-foot by 6-foot snooker table. It has six pockets on it. It has 22 balls. The balls are 2.25 inches in diameter. There's 15 reds, a yellow, a green, a brown, a blue, a pink, and a black. And then a cue ball, the white ball, which is very similar to pool. It's like a bigger version of pool. And every time you pot a red ball, you then have an opportunity to go for a colour, and the colours are worth more points. The reds are worth one. So if you potted 15 reds and 15 blacks, which is the highest value colour, and then all of the colours in sequence, you get what they call a 147. So that's, in theory, the max, or what they call max, a maximum break. And they're fairly rare, but I think there's been something like seven of them during the World Championships now.
Seven, you start compared to pool. In other words, there's the break, and then you go all the way. Is that what you're saying?
That's it, yes. And players play alternate shots. So if you fail to pot a ball, your opponent then gets the opportunity. And as you're potting, you stay on the table, you know. So it's just, usually the games would be a bit longer than pool. Pool has a fewer balls on the table. However, some of the better players, the likes of Ronnie O'Sullivan, who has just won the World Championship for the fourth time, has been known to get a 1-4-7 break in 5 minutes.
For Americans, give us some of the differences between pool and snooker. So is the pool table smaller or bigger?
A pool table, it would normally be half of the size, both width and length. So a pool table is very often 6 foot by 3 foot. A snooker table is 12 foot by 6 foot. So it changes the dynamics of the game hugely, you know.
Yeah.
So especially when you use a cue ball, the reason these guys that play pool and play snooker at very, very high levels, and girls, of course, are so good, it's because the cue ball is always in the perfect position. However, if you think about a table that's 12 foot by 6 foot, that's 72 square foot, and you're trying to put a cue ball that's 2.25 inches in diameter in a very specific place, that requires amazing skill.
Now, the black ball, the 8 ball in pool, has a specific raison d'etre in snooker, right?
Yes. Well, the black ball is the most valuable ball in snooker. It's worth 7 points. It's also the final ball that anybody would pot in a game if you were to clear the table. So after all 15 reds are potted and probably colours with them, you then go in sequence, you pot yellow, green, brown, blue, pink and black. Now, black being the highest value, it means that you have to do less work to win a frame.
Now what if the black goes in by mistake? What's the punishment?
It's a penalty, it's a foul shot, and it's 7 points, which is awarded to the opponent. So if I'm playing and I accidentally knock against the black out of sequence, or by knock against it, I mean I hit that when I was actually going for a different ball, or if I pot the black, well then it's 7 points to my opponent.
My favorite character in this whole thing, also staying at the Mirac Hotel, was the umpire. This guy was terrific, and, you know, he looked like Frank Langella, and he stood up very tall, and he, not an emotion showed on his face, and not a piece of dirt on his clothes or his gloves, which he had on. Tell us a little about the umpire.
Well, that particular guy you're talking to is a guy from Holland, the Netherlands, called Jan Verhaas, and these guys are there to make sure the rules are followed properly by the players, and to make decisions where there is a difference of opinion between players. So, for example, one of the rules could be if you miss an object ball that you're going for and the referee thinks that you haven't made a good enough an attempt, he can call a miss, which is a foul, 4 points to your opponent, but the referee then has to put the balls back in the position they were in before you took that shot.
Does anybody ever fight back?
Oh, every now and again, it's been known that people will have a serious difference of opinion with referees, but they can be warned about their behavior. And it's very, very rare that, you know, a referee would award a frame for unsportsmanlike conduct or whatever.
Anybody?
It's a real gentleman's game, you know.
Anybody ever get expelled? You know, have to go to the penalty box?
Actually, there's an interesting story. There's a gentleman, Alex Higgins, the Hurricane, they called him here. He won the World Championships in 1972 and 1982. But Alex was a little bit temperamental, shall we say. And Alex used to smoke all of the time. And then they banned smoking, of course, in the events. But Alex sort of always had a bit of a twitch. And he got very, very hot-headed when things didn't go his way. And at one stage, he was playing in the World Championships, and he decided he didn't like what a referee was saying, so he threatened to have him shot. So needless to say, Alex got a ban, which effectively ended his career. So every now and again, you do get something happening that is a bit out of the ordinary. The current world champion has been known to make a few comments which are would be ill-advised in any sport, shall we say, and there's one or two other players who have a tendency to be quite opinionated and maybe should consider what they're saying before they say it.
Now, back in the day, Martin Daly, when things were really bad between the South and the North, was there still inter-country play?
Yes, it's funny. Sport really doesn't know any boundaries. Sport is a great leveler, and even when there was a sort of sectarianism and issues going on in Northern Ireland, which, I mean, in fairness, is only 110 miles from where I sit to Belfast, you know. The reality is there was always sort of the North versus the South in tournaments and competitions. Even when I started to get involved in running amateur snooker, there was a competition that we devised called the All-Ireland Club Championships. And it's a club event where five players from clubs actually play, and the top teams from all around the country then, and each province then, get involved in a finals in Killarney. So that sort of thing has been there. Even the Dublin Billiards and Snooker Leagues have had a challenge match with Northern Ireland for years, where they take different players at different levels and different divisions. And one year it would be played in the South, the next year it would be played in the North. So there's always been that camaraderie, shall we say, in sport. And it's great to see, in fairness, and it breaks down barriers and gives a much greater understanding to the situations that people find themselves in, like all good sportsmen should do, you know.
Martin, what about the crowd behavior? Roselle and I, as we sat there, transfixed, watched the crowd. You couldn't, as I said before, you couldn't hear a thing. Does anybody in the crowd ever violate, you know, sort of the informal rules of behavior?
It's very rare that it happens. It has been known every now and again that somebody's phone will ring in the middle of a match or something. But very often the players, it just breaks the players' concentration and their flow of thought and their focus on what they're doing. And usually you'll find the player just steps away from the table to regather his thoughts. And very often he might sort of say, you know, it's for you, and talking to his opponent and laughing, you know. nearly like it's gamesmanship. But the very odd time now, crowds can be very, very partisan with, you know, depending on where a tournament is. So there have been a few issues where the crowd have gotten very loud and vociferous in support of one player, which is really put other players off. But if somebody steps over the line, the referee will ask that the person be removed from the audience, you know.
I noticed that when the thing began, somebody stepped out and said, this is being televised. Yeah. How much television play did they get?
Well, it depends on the television companies, to be fair. So the snooker actually gets pretty good coverage right throughout Europe and Asia. So BBC televised three or four of the main tournaments, including the World Championships. But Eurosport then cover most of the other main tournaments. So you'll get most of the main tournaments are actually covered one way or another on one of the different TV stations here in Europe. So so they get a fair bit of coverage. And that would even include some of the very early rounds and the wildcard rounds, which give TV exposure to up-and-coming players or new players, and sort of helps bring maybe a bit of sponsorship their way or whatever, and helps cover their costs, especially if they're new. It can be very, very expensive sport to be starting to get involved in while you're waiting to break through, as they say, you know.
Do they bring their wives with them and lovers?
Sometimes. It depends on where the tournaments are. It depends on maybe the duration of the tournament as well. So, for example, maybe the players from Europe, let's say traveling to the likes of China, might decide that, well, we're in China this week, and if I've qualified for this tournament and the next one, I have a week of a gap, and then I go to Australia, which we might as well make a holiday out of it, and I'll go out to Thailand, then I'll go spend a week in Australia before the tournament starts. And
do they get sponsors? In other words, they get people who say, because it's expensive to fly around. How does that work?
Well, some get sponsors, but in fairness, with the economic situation for the past 2-3 years, anyhow, it's been pretty near impossible to get sponsorship for individual players. What they get might just cover their accommodation costs and hotels or whatever. It'd be very, very small. However, the prize money for what they class as foreign tournaments, so the long-distance tournaments, is significantly increased for the first round, which means anybody who has to travel there is guaranteed that they're getting well covered for costs. So even if you have to pay the equivalent of, $1,300, let's say, by today's standards for flights, and then maybe $1,000 for the accommodation, the first round prize money could be up by $3,500. So you're well covered on that score, you know.
When we were there, two of the three, you were kind enough to give us tickets for one of them, but some of the others were sold out. Are there scalpers, as there are in America, selling tickets?
It happens, but usually really only for the very top competition. So the likes of the World Championship Finals and the likes of maybe the Masters or something like that. But in all honesty, it doesn't really happen that much, because the people who are really into snooker have a tendency to be players, and they play in leagues and they know the people they should contact about getting tickets. So, you know, it's like, as I always say, you know, where people are short of tickets. You know, if Barack Obama wants tickets to see a snooker match in Ireland or in England, he's going to get them. So my usual comment then is, Barack doesn't want the tickets, can I have them instead? You know, but there's always got to be some tickets around, or somebody's got some tickets. And if you know, you know, people have contacts. And you know, it's amazing that I've never ever had to pay over the odds. And obviously, these days, now that I manage a professional, I don't need tickets; I get a pass. But
sure.
I've never seen anybody having to pay. And in fact, as often as not, I might get phone calls for tickets for the World Finals or something, and I can generally organize that for friends.
Martin, is there anything going on in America snooker-wise, or should you say snooker?
There's not at the moment, which is unfortunate. There was some discussion about a tournament to be held in Las Vegas a few years ago, and I think it's surprising, because I mean, you know, I think America's a great country, and they put such dedication into sport and that sort of thing. I'm a bit surprised nobody's really come from America and tried to get involved in this sport, because, you know, there's such proficiency with pool players and that in America, and so big pool is in America, this just seems like a natural progression. And in fact, some of the lady players, the likes of Kelly Fisher and Julie Kelly, all were ex-lady professional snooker players and lady amateur snooker players, and they've all moved into the American pool circuit. So I think it's a natural progression, and something will happen. And I have noticed in the likes of Boston and New York, there are a few snooker clubs around, but they are few and far between. I even noticed one in California there a few years ago, and I kind of thought, you know, Santa Barbara was not the place I expected to see a snooker club, but there was one there nonetheless. So
you said you were a manager. I take it you take care of, you know, all the accommodations and where they're going and how they're going, your principal, but also the endorsements.
Yes, I think it's every player needs somebody to look after bits and pieces for them. And traditionally, managers usually would get paid about 20% of the earnings of the player. In my case, I don't believe that that's right. I think the player's earnings are the player's earnings. And I know Fergal, the guy I managed for a long, long time, and he was always very good and always gave something back to amateur snooker, which is where I met him and how I met him. So really, my function is to make sure that the flights are organized, that they, you know, for example, today I registered him to play in the first two tournaments coming up, which is the Wuxi Classic in China and the Goldfields Open in Australia.
I'm astounded by how articulate and wonderful you are at explaining all of this. When I met you, I knew I wanted to get you to explain snooker. And I got to say, I wasn't disappointed at all. I love your accent. I love Ireland. And I just think it was a wonderful experience running into you and having your generosity getting us into this thing. Thanks so much, Martin.
No problem. I'm sure next time you're over, give us a ring and we'll get you to meet the player himself.